than the self-screening process.
It's my understanding that, that process occurs through the job order process. And well, guess what I'm not, what I'm hearing in the bill is that if an employer doesn't request a job order process as a result of this piece of legislation, that the Employment Service would provide some lesser informational service on a bulletin board that might include simply a listing of job openings and the name and address and phone number of the appropriate public agency.
Okay, well, what we're trying to get to was the actual, without specifying specifically the job order had to be written, to make that a clear matter of intent, and Ms. Leonard has said, yes, I understand that that is your intent if this bill passes, that you want a job order written for each one of these vacancies that we receive from local government. So are you satisfied if, indeed, a job order is created and that kind of screening process occurs?
I don't know if, you know, satisfied is the word to use. What we will do is certainly encourage employers, and I think they will encourage themselves as they look at this process, to use that means to do some screening, because they, again, we are not in a situation of having a shortage of applicants, so I think to make sure that we get no more than those who have been screened and therefore have met some minimum qualifications, and we really need available to do that. And that means using essentially the current job order process, then that is what I think most employers will do, as opposed to asking for something lesser, such as, oh, just put my list up on the board and see what happens.
Yeah, well, I understand from the White House that prosperity is just around the corner, and you may have a shortage of applicants in the very near future as everybody goes in those lucrative private jobs.
Okay.
Mr. Berger, any other comments?
No, I don't think so.
I guess it's, I think we've got it out all on the record. I'm just still not really sure that we really need this bill in any form, frankly. I think about it, the less I like it.
Okay, members, just to sort of bring you up to speed, we have the original bill. There was also distributed a hand-engrossed version of the bill, which incorporated Representative Leek's first set of amendments. It's my understanding those set of amendments did away with the contractor provisions because of some concerns expressed. The second set of amendments bear the date April 25th, 1983, those amendments can apply either to the original bill or the hand-engrossed version. Basically, it's just all new language for a new subsection 2 under 657.710. The second set of amendments takes out as well the contractors and provides the language that's set forth there, and basically the balance of the bill is deleted. And the new language in the new subsection 2 is just on the April 25th, 1983 amendment. So you can either look at the original bill or look at the hand-engrossed version. The amendment would apply to either. The amendments incorporated in the first amendments are subsumed in the second set of amendments as well. So, Representative Leek, let me ask if there's any other testimony. If not, Representative Leek?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, once again, the purpose of this bill is to do what many of us, I think, have assumed is going on already over the years, and that is to get public job notices available through the Employment Service. It's not happening. This gives some guidance to agencies that should happen. It includes no penalties, and with the proposed amendments from the Employment Division, it leaves the process open for considerable administrative discretion so that we don't end up with all kinds of administrative headaches behind this. So I think this would be a good improvement to our system. We do know from research, and I'll provide that information to members later, that only 57% of state jobs are now, actual job openings, are now listed with the Employment Service. So we have a long way to go, both with the state and also with the political subdivisions. So, in that in mind, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the amendments to House Bill 2804 prepared by the Employment Division, dated April 25th, 1983.
Okay, Representative Leek moves the amendments, proposed amendment to House Bill 2804, prepared by the Employment Division, bearing the date April 25th, 1983.
That's subject to review by council.
We will assume that to exist and to be performed. Is there any further debate or discussion on Representative Leek's motion? Is there any objection?
Yes.
Okay, we have several. The clerk will call the roll on the amendments.
Leek?
Aye.
Shiprock?
Aye.
Rajati?
No.
DeBoer?
No.
Ford?
Aye.
Gold?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Johnson?
I'm going to vote aye.
Springer?
Aye. Okay, the amendments are adopted. Representative Leek?
Move the bill, move House Bill 2804 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Okay, is there further discussion?
I think...
Representative Johnson?
I think with the amendments, there may be a chance that it might do a little something, but I'm not sure it's really necessary, and hence I'm going to vote against the bill.
I, too, feel the same way, and I don't think it's... I think they're doing the job now. Those jobs are notified either in papers or in some agencies that are... And I think it's just an added big burden on the employment office. So I'm going to be a negative vote, too.
Okay. Any further comments? Vote explanations? Okay, if not, the clerk will call the roll.
Shiprock?
Aye.
Rajati?
Nope.
DeBoer?
Nope.
Ford?
No.
Gold?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Leek?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. House Bill 2804 to the floor. Due pass is amended. Representative Leek, I assume you would wish the honors.
I'll take the hot potato, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And if you would make that information from legislative research available at your earliest convenience so it can be made a part of the record, and we will ask legislative council to screen the amendment just in case there are any technical glitches. Okay, House Bill 2392. There are proposed amendments to this provision. Let me first of all put before the members of the committee a motion to take from the table the four bills that are scheduled for work session and hearing this morning, and also another bill that's scheduled for hearing and work session tonight in the subcommittee on benefits, which is, and I'll read the five bill numbers and then place the motion. We have on the table, and the motion would be to take from the table House Bill 2392, House Bill 2426, House Bill 2019, House Bill 2651, and House Bill 2700. The chair would move that those five bills be taken from the table for purposes of hearing and work session today and for what action that the committee feels is appropriate. Is there any discussion of the chair's motion? Is there any objection? If not, the bills are removed from the table. Okay, on 2392, the council is distributing amendments prepared by Representative Shiprock and a hand and gross copy of the bill. Senator Houck has asked for an opportunity to testify. Senator, if you'd like to come forward at this time. I don't know if you've had a chance to see copies of the amendments, but you may be informed of what their purpose is. But
I have the amendment.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Senator Houck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is C.T. Houck. I reside at 1390 Valley View in Salem, Oregon. I represent Senate District 17, which is the northern half of Salem and Kaiser. I'm here to speak in favor of House Bill 2392 and the amendments. Legislative Council amendments dated 4/21/83, which are the amendments prepared by Representative Shiprock. The amendments in the bill, as amended, addresses a problem that's reaching epidemic proportions in the construction industry, and that's the loophole in the existing law that allows a individual or group of individuals to form an independent contractor, and under the existing law to become, if they so elect, become exempt from paying workman's compensation. That in itself is not the problem of this group of people. It's the problem comes if one of these people get hurt and the company that has formed, it takes very little to become an independent contractor. All you have to do is to advertise or have a business card or a telephone or a pickup with no assets. There's no particular check on the stability of the company. So if one of these individuals get hurt, the company having no assets, it relies on the workman's compensation fund under a fund called Noncompliance Employers Reserve Fund to pay the medical bills and to help the injured worker. What is happening is that fund is under real duress. The last year there was $1,450,000 of these claims paid out. This year there's expected to be $1,650,000. The bill and the amendments to the bill speak to this problem and plugs this loophole. I would certainly urge that you give due consideration to the bill and support the amendments, because they speak to a problem that is, as I said earlier, an epidemic proportion in our business. I'd be only too happy to answer any questions that any member would have. If not, thank you for hearing me.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
It's my understanding we've eliminated the real estate activities section of this bill. Is that correct?
That's correct. I think what I might do is maybe ask or recognize Representative Shiprack if he'd like to take the witness table.
Sure.
And if you'd like to be joined by anyone, Representative Shiprack, feel free to ask them to come up, and maybe you can give us a little bit of the background on these amendments.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Representative Bob Shiprack from House District 23, Clackamas County. I've spent a considerable amount of time with various interest groups on these amendments. It, as Senator Houck has mentioned, it is a big problem in our industry. Senator Houck is a contractor, an employee in the construction industry, and we both recognize this problem. I use this bill because there is a bill, I believe, in the Senate, which does what the original House Bill 2392 intended. And as you remember, this committee tabled this bill some time ago because of that. So it does have the right relating clause and fit right in with what I wanted to do. And I'd like to speak to the proposed amendment now, if I may.
Let me interrupt here. Mm-hmm. Representative Shiprack, have you had a chance to speak with your brother Otto about the fact that...
I was just asked that. Brother Otto, I don't know if... I didn't speak to him about this, no.
Okay.
I'm going to tell him that the same thing I'm telling the committee, that the intent of this, the original bill, is embodied in a Senate bill. And I would expect Representative Otto to endorse this. However, I will speak to him about it.
Just as a matter of courtesy, you and I might both share with him that, and for members of the committee, for their information, we have received from the Senate, and the bill has been referred to our committee. It's Senate Bill 449, which deals with the situation. I believe that the direct sale of the real estate sales people are particularly concerned about, so it's not as if we're ignoring the issue. It will be before us, and I'm going to assume that Representative Otto will recognize that, will not have any objections, but go ahead.
Better
I hope so.
Bill, wouldn't want him mad.
No.
Okay.
As Senator Houck has briefly described, we do have a problem in the construction industry. You have to understand that the term partnership is a common law term, which may mean a verbal agreement or a handshake. And you have to understand, in the construction industry, we don't work every day. So there are times when an employee or a group of employees, for one specific employer won't work for some period of time, and they may actually go out and contract against their employer. Another example would be a number of people getting together, getting a pickup, and going into business as a partnership. Usually they'll have one person keep whatever books are kept. And because of the partnership status, that they are exempted from workers' compensation and other employer taxes. You'll remember Joe Blevins, an ex-accountant for workers' compensation, testified at this committee that he believes 60% of all income earned in the construction industry was not reported. I think that may be high, but he's certainly not wrong. There's a great deal of employer taxes not collected in my industry. One thing this amendment would do would be to force these people to pay something every reputable businessman pays, and that's workers' compensation. And as we all know from this committee, the comp rates in construction are probably the highest amongst the classifications because of the risks involved. In these times, someone with a 10% bidding advantage, you'll have a carpenter, roofer, for instance, extremely high rates, and based on percentage of payroll, that is a tremendous bidding advantage when you don't have to figure those costs into the bid. And in these times, that provides an unfair bidding advantage to against other contractors, and that because of the intense competition in the industry, those people are likely to receive those jobs. The second problem this amendment solves is one that particularly disturbs me, that this is what Senator Houck hit upon. Assume that you hire a partnership to roof a house, and one of them falls off that roof and is injured. That person may then claim he was an employee. Remember that the partnership was formed maybe over a handshake, nothing writing, and you would then be liable for that person's workers' comp claim and benefits. If there was no one who could be assigned that claim, then every person insured was safe because they are responsible for the non-complying employers would have that claim added to their insurance costs. Imagine the employer who had a few of his employees compete against him and receive a job he had bid on, and then one of them subsequently got hurt, and then indirectly that employer would pay for their workers' cost benefit, a workers' comp benefits. Thirdly, I want to point out that in the construction industry, these partners are exposed to the exact same risk as anyone else. The framer, roofer, whatever, has just as much chance of injury as a bona fide employee working for a contractor. Finally, this amendment will greatly aid the compliance division of workers' comp when they check a job or act on a complaint. They see someone driving nails or pouring concrete or installing pipe. That person must have workers' compensation coverage no matter what he may claim to call himself. I should point out that presently a sole proprietor, independent contractor, or partner may obtain workers' comp coverage under ORS 656-128. Many of them do. So the apparatus is already in place on the statutes. The genuine independent contractor, as defined in 656-029, may still opt out of coverage under the conditions set forth in that statute. And I'll try and answer any questions you may have.
Okay, Representative Shipwreck, let me ask you, each of the bills on the balance of our agenda deals somewhat with this issue. Would you wish to comment on those other bills and how your amendments relate to those other bills, or would you prefer to wait just a bit?
I'd like to wait. I would like to hear the testimony on those. They relate, however, to the independent contractor. We're dealing with terms. Independent contractor, sole proprietor, and partnerships, all differing. Every agency in state government has a different interpretation of that. It's something I found in researching this bill is that we hope that we can bring these definitions together for all these agencies, revenue, unemployment, or the employment division, and workers' comp. But I want to listen to the testimony on that, but they certainly do relate to this, yes.
Okay, well, not a lot of folks signed up right away, but I'm going to issue a general announcement to folks who have not signed up and wish to testify, or those who have signed up, that when I call them, if they wish to testify about or respond to each of the bills, they can feel free to do so rather than taking each one necessarily in sequence, since there is an interrelationship there, and a lot of the background information that applies to one could easily apply to another as well.
Yes.
And I know that Representative Troop has asked to testify, and he has three folks here who are going to be testifying with him at 10 o'clock because of his schedule and Revenue Committee and some of the work down there they're doing. I wanted to give him kind of a time certain that he could count on testifying. And so we're going to be receiving that testimony about 10 o'clock. And to remind members, we're going to have to adjourn just shortly before 10:30. That's when session is due. Representative Brigiotti.
Question, Bob. Are you saying that most contractors like yourself are
I'm not a contractor.
Right? Well, I mean, you are a... Well, aren't you a
please
wiring contractor?
No, I'm just an Indian. Career district, that's a bad term.
Watch out. We have a reservation out there for you. Well, I guess what I'm saying, don't you carry some kind of protection of your own, though?
No, Representative Brigiotti, I do not contract in any way. It is illegal for me to contract. Because of the state electrical license law. I am a bona fide employee. I work for contractors, and they carry workers' compensation on me. I do not compete in any way with my contractors.
Well, the intent of this was, of course, real estate when it started mm-hmm. out. And, of course, they are more or less independent contractors. In other words, they do their business. So they're not paid unless they mm-hmm. sell something or something like that. And I guess what I have a problem with is trying to figure out how many people out there that actually are an independent contractor themselves. In other words, they hire no one.
Mm-hmm.
I thought possibly you or that breed of Indians.
No, as I mentioned, the bona fide independent contractor, as defined in the statutes, would not be included under this. They have, and the Workers' Comp Division will explain this. This bill relates to those partners, these people that get together and go out and frame or put in sheetrock or do wiring. Strictly in the construction industry. Okay. There is a provision for the person you're thinking about.
Well, it's been a question for so many years.
Yes, it has.
Trying to see who really covers who in that mm-hmm. in that phase. And I can see where I have, my son is a contractor, mm-hmm. a builder.
Mm-hmm.
And he independently works it by himself. But he hires people to come in and do his, maybe not the framing, for instance, but the wiring, mm-hmm. sheetrock, and stuff like that. But they're also people that are probably on their own, too, you know.
Well, sure there are.
So what you're saying, then, in this bill is that he would be responsible for a person that was working with him as a partner.
Oh, he already is responsible.
Even though he hires the person that already covers himself? Yeah, I understand.
Absolutely.
That's what I hope we could get away from, but I'm not sure you're doing that with this bill.
Well, that's...
We have to... There are a couple distinct issues here.
Yes.
We may have to visit over lunch.
Okay. I think there'll be some people talking on that very issue, Representative Brigiotti.
Okay. Are these questions... Yes. Okay. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Shipwreck, is it your intention here to make this apply to, indeed, just sole proprietors as well? In other words, just an individual, to require him to carry a workers' comp and not be self-insured? Because that seems to be the, you know, the direction your amendment is taking here.
I'm gonna read 029 because I can see there's some confusion. A bona fide independent contractor. to whom the contract is let performs the work without the assistance of others, that person is subject to this chapter as a subject worker. What the Workers' Compensation Department, and I'm going to let them talk about this because I'm not too clear on it. There are provisions for the bona fide independent contractor, the guy who works by himself, doesn't hire people. It's already set up to where they can file a declaration of status as an independent contractor and is not eligible to receive benefits under this chapter unless he's obtained coverage. So there is a provision for that individual. He's not the guy I'm concerned about.
Okay.
And I hope the workers' comp will explain that further.
One further question, if I may.
Okay, let me interject that Mr. Young from the compliance division of the workers' comp department, who is sort of the recognized expert or the person that works very closely in this area, will be available to answer questions as well. But go ahead, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Shiprack, I was having a discussion about this concept over the weekend with a constituent who's a cabinet maker.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that from time to time, what happens, and he knows a number of other people that are in the cabinetry business, and sometimes he'll get some work and one of his competitors won't get it, or two or three of them will be working and the fourth or fifth won't be working. And so what they will do is to take individuals who work for their competitors and perhaps bring them in on their job. And this person doesn't have the characteristics of being an employee in most cases, but is, you know, just come on in and do this work and I'll let you work on the kitchen while I work on the living room or whatever the case is. And I guess my question is whether this type of individual would be considered within the confines of what you're talking about here.
If a person is asked to assist somebody, he would then become an employee of that person. Again, I'll have to defer to the experts. That's the problem. We've got people out there. In this case, that individual does not have coverage because he's no longer working for his employer. And if he was hurt on that job, then the other, if the person he was assisting isn't going to pay, in this case, I believe the workers' comp department would attempt to get him to pay for that claim, then that claim and benefits would be assigned to all the other people in that pool that the senator related to.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any further questions at this point for Representative Shiprock? If not, thank you, Representative. I know you put in a lot of time on this very difficult issue, and we'll keep our fingers crossed. Let me recognize John Gervais at this point.
Chairperson Springer, members of the committee, I just want to make a couple of quick...
I'll ask you to identify yourself and all that.
My name is John Gervais with the National Electrical Contractors Association. The comments that I'm making today are in regard to Representative Shiprock's amendments to House Bill 2392, but in some sense, in terms of a philosophy, would relate to some of the other concepts you'll be discussing. And the area of concern that I wanted to mention today is in regard to the construction person that goes out and sort of holds himself out as an independent person but are actually just an employee. There is the problem that was mentioned by Senator Houck in the construction industry, and I'd like to sort of add to that. And then a quick comment just in terms of what society requires us as contractors that are large enough to be identified to pay in terms of our employees. And I've got some raw labor costs here which show that in regard to our own people, we pay $3.05 an hour, just a mandated cost of society to keep a person going and active. And if you allow each and every person to get out of that responsibility, whether it be for themselves or other people working with them, then you give, number one, them an unfair competitive bidding advantage over our people who try to do the right thing as required by the state of Oregon. And you put some people out in terms of liability of getting hurt, not having any coverage, not being able to take care of that problem and their family and so on and so forth. But if just taking things like Social Security and workers' compensation and state unemployment taxes and federal unemployment taxes and other things required like that, that comes to $3.05 an hour. If you add in health and welfare costs that we have to pay, that's another $1.25, and mass transit taxes, and we go on and on and on. And so our objection is that every time you create an exemption, then you put a heavier burden on those that are in business legitimately, we think, paying the cost of doing business. That's all I wanted to say.
Any questions for Mr. Gervais? I assume your comment should be interpreted to mean that you support the bill as amended.
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Okay, Larry Young.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Larry Young, Workers' Compensation Department. There seems to be a question of, I guess I'll...
...2426 arises out of a long-term effort by the residential construction business to more clearly define who an independent contractor is and who an independent contractor isn't. Finally, last session, Representative Jim Crest, who chaired this committee, worked out an approach essentially that is covered in House Bill 2426. That bill passed the House almost unanimously in this. It went through Ways and Means Committee because it has a certificate process and had an impact on the budget of the Department of Employment. In Ways and Means Committee, a sunset of July 1 of 1983 was placed on the bill. This bill essentially removes that sunset, adds workers' comp coverage to the certificate, if you will, and removes one section or provision of the certificate relative to trying to keep track of written contracts. Before I get into the details of that, perhaps I should run through the one of the reasons why we need some kind of a certificate process, why we need some kind of a system to better delineate and clarify who an independent contractor is and who an independent contractor isn't. Perhaps to do that, I would like to take just a case study. I'd like to take the case study of Gail Havelrood, who operated under the assumed business name of Trim Service. And this essentially are the details of Trim Service. Operated under an assumed business name, in the year that the general contractor was audited, when Trim Service performed work for them, Trim Service had worked for 20 different general contractors and had in their own right 25 remodel contracts directly with consumers. Trim Service had built and sold two homes in that year. Trim Service regularly had 4 to 6 different contracts each month. Trim Service worked on as many as 3 contracts a day. Trim Service provided a bid, the case under the audit, Trim Service provided a bid for the job, had a written contract which required Trim Service to pay all unemployment compensation on all labor furnished under the contract. Trim Service had an investment in equipment of $30,000. Trim Service furnished some supplies and materials. Trim Service was not supervised and had the right to hire any employees they wanted to on the job site. They Trim Service worked whatever hours he wanted to work. Trim Service mailed statements to the general contractor at the month's end. Trim Service was registered with the Builders Board, bonded, carried liability insurance, used business cards, maintained an office in his home using typewriter, adding machine, and desk and similar office equipment. Trim Service was a member of the Home Builders Association. Trim Service, under their contract, guaranteed their work for a year. Trim Service had a business bank account, had a public accountant which assisted with business books. When the Department of Employment audited the general contractor, they declared Trim Service to be an employee. That was appealed to the Department of Employment Appeals Board. The Department of Employment Appeals Board sustained that Trim Service was in fact an employee of the general contractor. On appeal to the Court of Appeals and subsequently the Supreme Court, in the Republic Development Company versus the Department of Employment, both the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court sustained that Trim Service was in fact an employee of the general contractor. That audit occurred in 75 or 76. The case was handed down, I think, in 78. We have been trying to address that question because the general contractor, when somebody comes through the door and says, I want to assist you building on a house, doesn't know whether that entity or person can in fact be treated as a subcontractor or should be treated as an employee. We have been working very hard to try to devise some sort of a system so you can know, because there's federal withholding tax, state withholding tax, workers' compensation, unemployment compensation, all of which flow depending on whether they're an independent contractor or an employee. The employer is liable for them, obviously, if they're an employee. If they're an independent contractor, why the entity that comes through the door is liable for them. All four agencies use slightly different definitions. So while you may be an independent contractor for the purposes of state and federal tax withholding, you're an employee for the purposes of unemployment compensation and workers' compensation. The toughest law, if you will, well, the case also occurs where you are an independent contractor for the purposes of workers' comp, but not for unemployment comp, because the toughest law, or the one that classifies the most people as employees, is the Department of Employment law. That history, having been battered around the legislative halls for a number of years, led this committee last session to develop a certificate process that essentially is outlined in House Bill 2426. And they really set up sort of two standards. One was you came in and applied for a certificate. The certificate was good for 3 months. You had to demonstrate, and then you came back at the end of 3 months and got a certificate that was good for 2 years, and you had to demonstrate that you had so many contracts which and made so much money, if you will, during that period of time. That was one test. And the other test was you had to work under a written contract, and the provisions of the written contract arise on page 2, lines 31 through 36 on the bill. That is, you had to have a specific written contract, and you provide that you were free from direction and control. A call for, in effect, piecework basis, call for completion of a certain type, kind, or piece of work on a specific project. Specifies the individual shall be responsible for all employment taxes of employees or assistants, and places the individual clearly on notice that services provided pursuant to the contract shall not be considered wages for the purpose of unemployment compensation. So that's the system, essentially, that has been in place for the last year and a half. Unfortunately, there's been so little work in the construction industry that we haven't had a real good opportunity to test it. So, House Bill 2426 does three things. One is Section 3 removes the sunset, which is July 1 of this year, on this concept. Secondly, the new language on page 3 essentially broadens this to cover the cover workers' comp. And then the language removed on page 2, lines 7, and on page 1, lines 21, eliminates the test of the numbers of written contracts on reflecting on that we like the bill whether you do or don't remove the information on the written contract on the number of contracts. That seems like a lot of paperwork that doesn't get anybody anywhere. Was the reason that we suggest that standard be removed. Maybe I should pause right there, Mr. Chairman, for any questions we might have on those three issues, and then I'd like to talk for a little bit about the concept in 2392 and how they might be married together.
Okay, I think that's appropriate. Let me ask members of the committee if there are any questions so far as it relates to the information and presentation by Mr. Vanette on 2426. Okay. Mr. Meek, did you have anything you wanted to add at this point?
No.
Okay. Why don't we get into 2392 then?
The concept in House Bill 2392 essentially requiring sole proprietors and partners to pay workers' compensation for work they perform on the job site has been a concept that the Home Builders Association historically has rather strongly opposed. When the question arose relative to these amendments, we went back to our legislative committee and had a rather lengthy discussion about the concept, and we changed our position with the caveat, if you will, if we can develop a system where somebody can tell where the liabilities lie, we would support the broadening, if you will, of coverage to include sole proprietors and partners who work on a job site. So we would join those others who have testified in support of this if we can work, if you will, a little bit on the system so somebody can tell where the liabilities are, so we get a clearer line of knowing who is responsible for paying it. Under the present system, the general, if the person is an employee, where the general contractor is liable for paying it. We suggest that you take 2392 and 2426 and combine them in the same bill. I should also point out that the language occurring on page 3, line 14 of House Bill 2426 would have to be modified because that, if you adopt the amendments in 2392, because the language very clearly in 2426 says that you can't collect any coverage or you can't collect any benefits if you operate under this certificate. I think if you put the two of them together, people who are otherwise independent contractors may be paying for workers' comp, and if they pay it, they ought to be eligible to collect it. So if they elect coverage, they ought to be able to get benefits. That is if you buy off on the two concepts, that's a technical amendment to provide an exception that if you pay for the coverage, you ought to be able to collect under it.
Okay. Any questions at this point? Let me ask you, Mr. Van Ann, have you had a chance to discuss this idea of putting the two bills together with Representative Shiprack?
No, I have not, Representative Springer, except I mentioned it to him when he went over to get some coffee, and that's the so that he has had a chance to reflect on it momentarily. But I was not aware that until this morning that those amendments were going to come in on that vehicle, and we had an opportunity. We knew about the amendments. But as I sat and looked at them, and given our goal of trying to more clearly delineate where the responsibility lies, along with our approach to requiring more people to pay, it looks like putting them together in the same vehicle makes some sense.
Okay, without asking Representative Shiprack to necessarily commit himself to that proposition or that method. I think before we schedule our next work session, I would like to be able to hear from you and also anyone else that may be particularly interested in putting the two bills together, that you have reached some consensus, and also that you've prepared, if you will, an engrossed version that will accomplish that. And I don't care which bill it goes into or how it happens, but if there is an agreement that these goals are compatible and can be put in one bill, I think we'd be glad to go ahead and do that.
Representative Springer, we will certainly do that. I might make one more small plea, if you will, I guess, and it may be too late in the session to do that, but if there was some way for the committee to rewrite 027 and 029 just some average, ordinary lawyer who'd worked in the field for 10 years to understand how the two of them went together, it would certainly be helpful, because the patchwork that we have developed and the relationship between 027 and 029, very, very complicated, and I'm not sure an awful lot of people understand how they work together, including me. And I have tried to explain them to lawyers around for a long time, and that's the reason I brought Mr. Meek to the chair with me. In case you asked me any questions about him, I was going to defer them to him.
Okay. Well, I think two underlying principles in anything we do, hopefully, are, you know, keep it simple, and secondly, to try to avoid change every session, because people obviously have problems dealing with either situation. But to the extent that in our further discussion of these two subsections of ORS, we can find a way to simplify it without doing a whole lot of damage to people's understanding as to what we're trying to do in the basic policy, we'll sure keep that suggestion in mind, believe me. Any questions of Mr. Van Adder or Mr. Meek at this time? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We'll be in close contact with you, you can be sure of that. Okay, Mr. Russell, I see that you're available to entertain questions regarding 2426. Did you have a presentation you wanted to make as well, or why don't you come forward and at least identify yourself? And we'll put you on the record here.
Lee Russell of the Employment Division. Primarily to answer questions, just a couple of points that I think probably need to be pointed out with regard to the Employment Division law itself, and maybe a couple of comments on the contractor certification process that has been in effect since January 1, 1982. First of all, under the Employment Division law, there's a section that specifically defines who an employee is, and let me read, quote, what that section says. It's any person employed for remuneration or under any contract to hire, written or oral, express or implied, by an employer subject in employment subject to this chapter. So, as a starting point, any individual performing a service for another is an employee unless there's a specific exemption under the Employment Division law. And the Employment Division law does not have an exemption for independent contractors as such. There is an exemption similar to the independent contractor provision, but it isn't quite the same as an independent contractor exclusion. And you have to go back to the purpose of the unemployment law to understand why that original concept was put in the law and why it's still there. Many of these individuals, what we're talking about, those particular in, one of the big problems is in the building trades, the individuals working at the job site for on a piecework basis and so forth, their work, performing the same type of service as the individual working by the hour and so forth, many of them are subject to the same hazards of unemployment that the individuals working as employee is. I think the last two or three years has probably borne that out in the home building industry particularly. So the original intent of the law was to cover as many individuals that were subject to the hazards of unemployment as possible in making them employees of the individual for whom they're performing the service. So 657.040 is the statute in issue. The individual not only has to be free from direction and control, they also has to have an independently established business. And sometimes the requirements for an independently established business goes a little beyond being an independent contractor working on a piecework basis. With that, since the contractor certification process went into effect in January 1982, the Employment Division had geared up for quite an influx because of the problems that we've had in the home building industry. We spent some funds and so forth. We've had 56, in 1982 we had 56 individuals obtain a certificate. And as a result, one of the problems we have right now, this income from issuing the certificate was to pay for the cost of the program. Because of the gearing up process, we thought we were going to have maybe up as high as 4,000 individuals apply, because there is about, at that time was about 15,000 individuals registered with the Builders Board. And we had about 7,000 registered employers in the home building industry. We thought there's a potential of possibly 8,000 out there. We thought maybe as many as 4,000 might apply. At the present time, the Contractor Certification Fund has borrowed about $17,000 from another fund because of the administrative costs associated with the program. So we do have a deficit balance if this contractor certification program sunsets June 30th. We'll wind up with a $17,000 deficit that probably will have to come back to the next session or maybe go to Ways and Means to do some shuffling to take care of that deficit.
Mr. Chairman. Okay, let me, I missed the figure of those who have actually filed the certification. You anticipated 4,000. How many actually did?
56 in 1982.
56.
And there's been seven since the first of the year. Of course, with the June 30th sunset clause, the cost this year is $60 for a temporary certificate. And for a short period of time, there may not be too much interest in getting a certificate when the going to sunset June 30th.
Okay. Representative Shipwreck, I'll recognize you, and then I want to honor my commitment to Representative Troop to let him get on.
Sir, quick question. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Russell, is Section 1 of this bill, which relates to Section 3, Chapter 895, is that the current law that you're talking about?
Yes.
And this is what the Employment Division now uses as a criteria for establishing whether a person is or is not an independent contractor?
No, that isn't the only criteria. The individual comes in and applies for a certificate. He meets this criteria. We issue a certificate. Then that individual or partnership then is considered to be non-employees under the Employment Division law. other individuals that don't get a certificate, then we have to go back to 657-040 and apply that criteria to see if they meet that. If they meet that criteria as a non-employee, then of course the general contractor would not be liable for those services. But if they don't meet that criteria, then the general contractor would be liable for the tax on those services.
And then the way I read this, then the home builder's amendment would be to put this same test for those people in the workers' comp area also. That would be on page 3.
It would besides those that might file a declaration of status that are not in the home builder's industry, if they had a certificate from us, that's what it appears to me.
You'd have the same test in the employment division as you have in the workers' comp division. It's the way I read this. Maybe I'm wrong.
If the individual
shaking his head yes.
If the individual had the certificate, then it would be good for both both the workers' comp and the unemployment.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Russell. I'd ask you to stick around, too, for the balance of the hearing in case we have any other questions come up. Representative True.
Oh, what have we got here?
Stage fright.
I was running away from the bill.
You're on. Then you're gone.
I have three constituents that I'd like to introduce from Penn today, Jake and Virginia Wolf. Come forward.
You're going to pull up an extra chair if you can find one there, and we get everybody up.
I'll go ahead and stand and just briefly introduce the topic and then leave it to them. Virginia and Jake Wolf and Larry Irwin.
Great. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And I basically have introduced this bill at the request of these individuals and a problem they encountered. And House Bill 2651 really does not advocate changing the intent and the nature of this bill, but we do have difficulty in the implementation of the workers' comp question for musicians who are independent contractors. What seems to be occurring now is that we don't have difficulty with those bands and those individual performers who basically work with a nightclub or a few nightclubs in a community and are there to file the joint declarations that are required in order to be considered an independent contractor. But normally a club owner who is contracting with bands or individuals who are coming through town and coming in town for just a couple of performances negotiate with the agent, and the band may appear on Friday night or Saturday evening for a one-night stand or a two-night stand, come into town, and the way the law currently reads is that joint declaration has to be filed with SAFE, for example, in advance of that performance. And if they're not able to come into town while SAFE is still open and one can go and deal with that insurance corporation at that time, then it's difficult. It's impossible to have that joint declaration filed in advance. So essentially what this bill would do would be to say the existing law remains, but just gives 15 days after the performance for the joint declaration that has been filed both by the club owner and the band, gives 15 days for that to be filed. I think what I'd like to do at this time is to turn it over to Jake and Virginia and Larry to explain the specific problem that they've had, Ben, that a number of other individuals have also had, a number of other clubs, and let them explain the problem. Bill Cross from the Oregon Restaurant and Beverage Association also is interested in the bill. I don't think we'll be able to be here this morning. He's in a TECO board meeting, but I think he might be able to provide some additional information later. But again, it's not trying to change the law, just add a little additional flexibility so that joint declaration can be filed and the operative provisions of those statutes can then be operable.
Thank you. Great. Thank you, Representative True.
I'm Larry Irwin. I'm the average ordinary lawyer who's been in practice for 10 years that was mentioned earlier, I think. And preliminarily, I would like to say that it is difficult to advise clients whether they're an employer or not an employer for all three categories, be it workers' comp, withholding purposes, or payroll taxes. Specifically with reference to 2651, I view it as a fairly innocuous bill. and I think it's broader than just on the musician, but it applies to situations other than just the musician's situation. The law provides for the joint declaration certification process, and I assume we're going to keep that intact, but it doesn't provide, what the law presently doesn't provide for is how you file that joint declaration or when it becomes effective. The problem we've come up against is that, as Representative Troop mentioned, a band will come, you book with the agent, the band shows up Friday night. SAFE has taken the position, although the statute's just silent on it, that it's not only that they have to have it filed before the band starts, but they also have to approve it administratively. And unless they've approved it administratively, they have assessed and intend to assess. That has forced a lot of the restaurant beverage members to switch from, say, two independent private carriers. The private carriers take the position, get the bands to sign up, get us the declaration in some reasonable time period so we know whether they're covered or not. But I think it does need to be clarified or added to, and I think 2651 does that. The only change I would suggest or a matter for discussion would be the language about filing. As proposed, it says that the declaration is valid and effective if it's signed prior to commencement of work and filed with the insurer within 15 days. I can foresee problems with the word filed, whether that means actually received or mailed, and I think that should probably be clarified so that it doesn't create additional litigation or problems for people in that regard. That's essentially the problem that exists there. There, incidentally, I should probably bring to your attention is a companion, maybe not a companion bill, but another bill on a related matter in the Senate side, and that's Senate Bill 431. Under 657, the Unemployment Compensation Act, musicians are not exempted from payroll taxes, but if these nightclubs or the Elks Lodge or whoever it may be that hires a band enters into a written contract which provides that the leader is responsible for payroll taxes, then that shifts the responsibility to the leader of the group and takes it off of the contracting party, the employer, the nightclub, the Elks Lodge, whoever it might be. There are some clarifications that are being proposed to that statute, 657-506, which deals with shifting it to the leader of the band. But I just thought I would mention that because, again, it also relates to who is or isn't an employer under the situation. And I think Virginia Wolf or Jake can tell you a little bit more, if they want to, about the problems with the SAFE problem coverage.
Okay, let me just briefly ask Mr. Irwin, do you know if Senate Bill 431 has been heard by the Labor Committee yet? Or
it has not, as my understanding, it has not been scheduled.